Today is Tuesday, July 16th, and you're listening to The Job. A talk show about the web, design, music, business, culture, Portland. I'm your host, Raymond Briglip. Our guest on this episode, the 21st, is Tommy Harden of Wieden Kennedy's joint editorial. First, why don't we talk to Candace? Hi, Candace.
Hello, Ray.
How are you today?
I love the addition of chocolate to our recording table. This is great.
I'm excited about the subtraction of the recording table from this studio and our move to a new studio.
Oh, this is so exciting. Are we ready to announce?
We can talk about it now where it's official.
It's official.
It's official. Our move date is tentatively set to...
officially tentative. September 1st.
Brace yourselves.
We're going back to school.
We're going to... downtown. We'll be downtown in a much bigger space where we can all fit comfortably.
And a room for recording where you can shut the door.
Yeah.
That's very exciting.
Yeah, it's super exciting. It's in the White Stag building, if anyone knows where that is.
It's only the coolest building in all of Portland.
Let's see what else is new.
I mean, what can top that?
Yeah, I don't know what else to talk about. Are we still recording?
What else is new? Well, we made it back from camping.
Camped again. That was nice. By a river. Beautiful.
You can camp near rivers in Oregon. Who knew?
Camp all over the place.
It's awesome.
Only probably a half dozen gunshots were heard.
I don't know if I discussed the idea of baking cakes in oranges on this podcast. Yeah. Just in case I mention that, I'd like to say that it is an incredible waste of time.
I thought it was okay.
Except that when you have that much orange pulp left, you might as well make mimosas in the morning. That was a benefit. But the cake itself, the kids thought it was strange, and it wasn't very big.
Why don't you read a passage from that letter we got today?
Oh, we got the cutest thank you note from the Equality House.
Whose site we launched a couple weeks back.
Thank you. Yeah. My favorite part of this.
Yes.
Thank you for your service. Thank you for your support. And thank you for being as obnoxiously talented as you guys are. Keep doing what you do. Obnoxiously talented. You're being a little obnoxious yourself, by the way.
Just trying to capture your voice. Mm-hmm.
Anyways, this is also like hand-lettered and designed. It's quite beautiful.
It's pretty awesome, yeah.
Framing it.
For sure. It's nice.
It also makes me want to put out crayons and markers in the studio more. Maybe in the new space. We could just have a creativity room.
Yeah.
So we're on the hunt for a super awesome conference table.
Yeah. Although the room is only like how many feet long?
8x12, I think.
Oh, that's plenty.
I mean, how big of a conference table do you want?
It's probably going to be 8 feet long.
Oh, really?
That only leaves a couple of feet at each side for people to actually sit.
Or get around? Like, are people going to have to, like, crawl under the table to get to the other side?
No.
Okay.
We don't want to select it. We don't want to select a table that's that big.
No. So maybe a short table. shorter table.
Well, I would say a table that's 8 feet long would be just fine. Don't you think?
Mm-hmm. So we met with are they the architects that are there?
That we building met? Management.
Building management. And we struck up a conversation about Eames with them. And they had mentioned that they didn't realize that they had designed furniture, but that they were big fans of their building work, their homes.
Yeah.
So I am just excited to blow their minds with these desks. It's like the first time I feel like someone's going to be able to see and appreciate our desks. That space is like so big, they're just going to sit right in the middle. It's going to be great.
That's a good point. Nobody really sees the desks here so much. You'd think, but I can't believe we have three of those things.
We need one more so they can be like in a square together in the middle. Just like a little, what did they call it?
Bullpen.
Bullpen, yeah. I love a bullpen.
Yeah.
And a cot. I'd like to propose a standalone cot somewhere. I really do like naps. I mean, I don't want to give those up forever.
I don't know where you'd put a cot.
I don't know either. That's why we need to get some creative, get our creative juices flowing and start doing a little bit of research.
There's just literally no room for a cot. I don't know how creative you can get with that.
I'm actually thinking of the room where we're going to do the recording.
Yeah.
Like, towards the wall, setting up a cot, and maybe the sound of rushing water.
Are you talking about a hammock?
Yes, hammock. Yes, that would be better. Hammock.
Could you just lay on the table?
No. Sometimes I get tired enough, I think I probably could.
The conference room table is probably, we'll just get a padded
when
one.
The kids have been up enough in the night, yeah. Yeah, I think I could probably lay under the table. So, Tommy.
Yeah?
You've known him since you guys were little tots, right?
So Tommy is an old friend from high school. I actually ran into him, I guess like a week after he'd moved to Portland, just by coincidence, at like a Hollywood theater or something. We were going to see
Helvetica,
yeah. The documentary, and he was in line too, which was extremely odd. Quite a coincidence. So he is an editor with Joint Editorial, which is a facility, like a post-production video facility that Wieden Kennedy runs. So he's an editor. He's worked on a lot of commercial work that you've seen. And we talk a lot about that and about all sorts of other crazy stuff. So, yeah. Enjoy. From, I have to fill in a lot here because I knew you for a couple of years, but then I don't think I ever really knew your past, and then we were out of contact for a while. So yeah. Why don't you tell me where you're from? Start at the beginning.
Okay. Well, that's a question that everyone always asks that I have a really hard time answering because I moved a lot and like I never really lived anywhere, really one place for longer than like 5 years in my childhood. So. You knew me in Minnesota, and I was there for about 5 years. That was high school, basically. Mm-hmm. And then before that, I was in Kansas, you know. And then before that, I was, like, in Ohio. And then before that, I was in the South, in Georgia, you know, with my dad's family. So it was, like, just because of the work situation, I kind of was one of those kids that kind of got pushed around and moved around a lot. You know, so I usually, when I meet somebody and I'll ask them where they're from, and I'm like, oh yeah, I always can say I'm at least one state over, or like, right. Oh yeah, I grew up there too. Like people might say,
chameleon.
People might say, yeah, Wisconsin. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'm from Minnesota, which is not really, I'm not really from anywhere.
Right, right.
I've now lived in Portland longer than anywhere else in my life.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that's probably true of me too, yeah. So how long have you lived in Portland?
A little over 6 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh. So did we run into each other? Like, that must have been soon after you moved.
That was
here.
Like the week I got here.
Oh,
like,
that's crazy.
That was the first movie.
I had no idea.
That was the first movie I ever saw in Portland, and you were in line.
That's even more
right,
of a
like right in front of me, or right behind me, or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, huh. So, I remember. So, for our listeners,
yeah.
You work in film. Are you an editor?
Yes.
Okay. I have memories of you in that era of like shooting with a Super 8 at the railroad tracks or something. It's such a like stereotypical like. Yeah, the train yard. I don't suppose you have any of that stuff you shot.
You know what? I have actually, I've got the exposed film in a box somewhere in my basement. I never, because I tried getting it processed once, but back then I didn't really know who did Super 8 film anymore.
Right.
And I know who does them now, but I just have yet to ever like dig in and see if it actually works. Because I remember I didn't really know how to use that camera really well.
Right.
And at one point I thought I was still filming stuff, but it wasn't really filming. So I don't really know what what that looks like. It'd be fascinating.
Yeah.
It'd be fascinating.
Yeah.
If I found it.
For a while I was really into light bleed. I had like some cheap camera, and you know it just got carried away with it, and it's like half of the shots were just like white or orange
right.
or
yeah
you know. But yeah, yeah, so I won't ask you about Reba.
She is great. Reba is a fantastic
good,
woman,
good on tour, yeah, just like keeps
just
the spirit
really
on.
Kind yeah
yeah. So how did in between that filming trains
yeah.
And what you do now, how did you get from point A to point
okay,
B?
Okay, that's a good question.
Thank you.
Well, it's kind of convoluted. I think what probably inspired me to pick up that camera back then is we went and we watched a bunch of like old REM videos. You know,
oh, sure.
You know, like from Reckoning and stuff, and it all felt...
We were into REM.
Yes, it really... And that was the first time that I saw... moving images of some sort that I thought, oh, that'd be cool. I want to do that. Or that'd mm-hmm. be, that's, it felt artistic in a way and something we could actually do.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I never necessarily thought of myself as like, oh, I want to make movies or I want to make a movie or be a filmmaker in that regard. And so I took more of an art school approach to it initially. And so when I got out of high school, I moved to North Carolina. And I spent a couple of years not really in school, but not really knowing what I was doing. I was doing like math, like degrees and stuff like that. And then I dropped out and then I went into art school. And so that was the first time that I started like thinking about things artistically I started doing photography and painting and stuff like that. But I had a hard time kind of finding one particular thing. I liked it all, and I still really liked music. Music was still really important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I kind of just dropped out of art school for a bit, tried to figure it out, and then I moved to New Mexico. I didn't really know what I was doing. I just was just out driving around, and it was a beautiful place to live. And so, but then they've had a film school there in New Mexico, the College of Santa Fe.
Mm.
And I didn't even know they had a film school there. I just knew I needed to go back to school somehow and like actually finish.
Right.
And they had a decent art school there. And so I went to the art school and they were like, you should check out the film program. They have really interesting people over there teaching. And so when I got there, they just totally spoke my language. They were like, we're interested in sort of doing really experimental stuff. We're interested in just hearing the artist's voice. We don't really do Hollywood films. We're interested in doing, and everything you do is like, you do it yourself. We'll just give you the cameras and go out and shoot. And we'll look at films you hadn't seen before. And it was also really, so that became like this multidisciplinary thing that was attractive to me, is that I wasn't really gonna be like a photographer or a painter or something, or a musician, but I could sort of put music and put photography and put, you know, acting or even like just color and like all those sort of artistic things all kind of come together in weird ways in film, and that was really attractive. And I've also, as in arts, you kind of got to be a bit of a recluse sometimes if you're going to be a painter or something, so it's just so solitary.
Right.
And to do your own thing, and I was never good at that. Yeah. I kind of needed the interaction. And so filmmaking and in general is just so, you've got to be collaborative because there's just so much work to be done and there's so many things that need to happen. You got to be able to like deal with people and talk to people. So it was great. The people I was in that film school with were just really cool people, and we all just sort of helped each other out and just kind of learned from each other and just did cool stuff. And they showed us stuff like just like crazy shit that you would never have seen mm-hmm. otherwise. Mm-hmm. The other note to make about that school is Matt McCormick, who's from here in Portland. He went
there. Sure, I know Matt.
Yeah. He was there just before I was.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so then editing. So I basically had to get a job out of film school, and then I was actually thinking I would be in camera, like in cinematography, and I went and worked on this really awful, low-budget horror film as a camera loader, a clapper loader, and I just understood, like, being on set and being in production, it's almost like a military operation, and there's not really all that many people being super creative unless you're the director or maybe the DP.
Right.
Everyone else is just pretty much like a soldier, and I was like a camera donkey, you know, and mm-hmm. and I couldn't really talk to anybody about the whole collaboration thing, which wasn't happening at all, and then after talking to people, I realized that the editing room is a much more sort of like open space to kind of talk about creative ideas, and you get to actually get to see the film that you're working on, whereas if you're on a movie, you could be working on that thing for months and you never see a frame of film until it comes out in the theater, and it's like, don't you want to know what you're working on?
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, so it just seemed to me that it became clear that the editing room was just sort of a much more interesting place to be. And so when I moved to Los Angeles after film school, and I just tried to work any connections I could to kind of get into film editing.
So when you were in school, were you working on like, was it digital? Were you doing digital then, or was it like
an it was both. Okay. It was both. They had us, you know, shooting all formats, both shooting video and shooting film. And they also had us editing. Like they wanted you to learn how to edit the old school way first, mm-hmm. and then they kind of slowly. Huh. So they had an Avid there, which I learned. That's the software I use today. Mm-hmm. But I started off with reel to reel, you know, which was great.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. So how did you go from that to, I don't know, Portland?
Okay.
Making commercial?
Yeah.
I mean, what would you essentially describe the genre you're working in as?
Yeah, it's advertising.
Okay.
Yeah. So so when I got to Los Angeles, I didn't really know, like, it's all about who you know there. Yeah. And I didn't really know that many people, but I'd had one connection at Universal Pictures. And they were like, okay, so what do you want to do? And I was like, well, editing. Mm-hmm. And they were like, editing what? Meaning that, like, what I had to quickly learn was that it's like an assembly line there, and it's like a big factory, and it's all like all these departments are completely broken down into boxes, and they were like, where are you going to fit into this box? And since it was the only connection I had, I was like, oh, you know, just show me around. I don't know, just let me figure it out. And so I was like an intern there, basically. And Ray, it was awful. It was like, it was awful. So, I mean, imagine like, my film school was very DIY. Portland, the whole Portland aesthetic is just so DIY. It's like, you want to be, I'm a generalist, you know, that's what I just described. It's like having my hand in everything.
Yeah.
And there, just editing departments at a big studio, it's divided up completely into different departments. And so say you've got picture editing, and then you got sound editing. And then in sound editing, you've got dialogue editing, you've got music editing, and you've got sound effects editing.
So different the stuff that appealed to you about editing wasn't really happening.
No. And it's like, there's like rows and rows of like long hallways with dark rooms, and it's like, and the guys are like hunched over, you know, looking over their shoulder, like in a paranoid, like, don't fire me. And these are all talented guys, you know, really smart guys, but they all have the same lava lamp on their desk, and they had like a picture of their family, and they were just sort of like, I'm working as hard as I can, man, you know, on like TV shows and stuff. And I was just like, I would come home and I'd be like, oh my God, like, I'll do it if I have to, but shit, like, is this what I signed up for?
Yeah.
But, you know, how could you say no? It's Universal Pictures. It's right. Like, it's the movies. It's the fucking movies. You know? So, I mean, like, I was sitting there, like, going, oh, shit. And then I wasn't really all that happy. And then I met somebody. Well, that's like a family friend who was, like, an old school Hollywood producer. And she was just like, what do you want to do? And I was like, oh, I want to be an editor.
I love people in L.A. talk. It's awesome.
Yeah. And she's like, oh, hang on. And so she knew this editor who worked in commercials, and he was out in Santa Monica. She's like, let me call him up. And she just is like, hey, there's this kid. You should talk to him. You know?
Does he have like a beard and a cigar?
Yes. Yes. No, but she's like a legendary like connector. She just knows people, and okay, she's like gotten so many people jobs. So I go out and I go out and it's this editorial shop, and all they do is work on commercials and music videos.
Okay.
And it's just this tiny little office, maybe twice the size of yours or something, and you've got a handful of guys working, and they are there's like art magazines spewed out everywhere. There's like punk rock posters on the walls, and there's like music blaring, and I immediately walked in, and I'm like, these are my people.
Right, you know? It's more like it.
Yeah, and so I talked to them about what I just experienced, and they're just like, oh, yeah. We choose the music, or we work with the music, we do sound design, we supervise all the visual effects, we do everything, you know? We see the whole process through, which you can do if it's just 30 seconds.
Right.
You know? And they're like, look, and also, if you're talking about, like, doing cool shit or whatever, frame for frame, there's more money being spent on a commercial than there is on your average feature. There's uh-huh. just a lot more money going into it. So we work with like the coolest people, like some of the best mixers, sound mixers, so that we can get like the best like visual effects artists who work in the business to work on this stuff, and we get to hang out with these cool people and learn what they do, because there's just more resources to it. And they're like, but that said, he's like, he gave me a warning, and he's like, commercial editing is kind of seen as the redheaded stepchild of editing in LA. It's like, even though we work just as hard as everyone else and we're working with the best people in the industry, commercials has a taint to it.
Yeah.
And if you ever want to move into features or move into television, they're not going to see you as a real editor. They're going to see you as a commercial editor. Huh. And I was like, well, I was just in the feature world, and that is not fucking me.
Uh-huh.
And this looks really cool. And so that's what I did. And so I kind of just worked my way up. And it's a really kind of a small business. Like there's a ton of small shops, editorial shops, who work almost exclusively in commercials. It used to be music videos, but that all the money of that went away a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
But mostly it's commercials, and they're all in Santa Monica, and they all kind of cross-pollinate, you know? So I kind of learned about all those shops, and I kind of worked around to various places. And I kind of just slowly built up an editing reel based on some of the work that I got. You know, I would just jump on anything and just work on for free or whatever. Uh-huh. And then I had known about Wieden & Kennedy in Portland, just because of the legendary work that they did there. It's just, you know, there's a sort of golden, in the entire world of advertising, there's this golden halo around Wieden & Kennedy.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just say Wieden, like, oh shit, Wieden's here, you know? And it was just always like that. And so I had no idea the joint, which is like the editorial shop inside Wieden, I didn't even know it even existed. And they don't really have to tell anybody that they have plenty of work coming out of Portland, that they don't really need to go down to LA and try and, or other agencies to try and like get work. So there's no reason for them to kind of like let anyone know that they exist. So I didn't know that they existed.
Huh.
But I would have jumped on it in a heartbeat. But anyway, so it just, they were looking for another editor. They were looking to grow, and like slowly the through the grapevine in that LA scene, I got wind of it, and I was like, I knew Portland was amazing. And I knew Wieden & Kennedy was amazing, so it's sort of like a no-brainer. So I just immediately sent them my work, and luckily it happened.
Yeah. So it's interesting your perspective. I think like talking about the red-headed stepchild phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I think it's like people assume that, and it's funny because I had the same conversation with a commercial photographer recently.
Yeah,
here on the job, saying a lot of the same thing. It's just like, you know, like commercial work is really fun, you know?
Yeah.
And especially if you're doing something that's 30 seconds as opposed to like 90 minutes or something.
Yeah.
It's going to be like one person is going to have a big picture.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, like, so a typical 30-minute spot, can you call it a spot?
30-second spot.
30-second spot.
You call it a spot.
30 minutes, it's not a spot.
Yeah, you can call it a spot.
How much of that are you doing? Like,
what do you mean?
I mean, do you... I can't actually be more specific. Like, how much of it are you doing? You
just okay,
like,
well,
you're not shooting.
No, but I often am on set at
okay,
the shoot.
Okay.
You know, which is a newer phenomenon. It didn't used to be that way.
So kind of like you're art directing it, make sure you get the coverage you need for a particular.
Yeah, more or less.
Okay.
I mean, often I don't. I mean, I think that the traditional way the editing used to be seen is that the editor was just always like at in his edit house,
right?
And then once the film gets all shot and everything's been written and he's gonna get shot, and then it gets sent to him and he assembles it together, right, you know, with the team of people who wrote it. Since really the business is changing and the way things get made are changing, and it used to be you could just have something on a piece of paper, like when you want to sell an idea to a client, you just write it on a paper and show it to them or read it to them, and they're like, okay, great. But now, because there's so much you could, like everyone's so addicted really to moving images, and mm-hmm. they kind of need to be able to see it, or if they can't just see it on the page, they kind of want to see a film or they want to imagine what that spot would look like, and so. That means editors are coming in earlier and earlier to the process.
But as an editor, are you involved in pitching the idea? Or
yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So not always, but occasionally. So especially if it's like a really big idea with a lot at stake. You know, if it's a smaller thing, it's no big deal. It's kind of like, well, we don't need to make a video for it. Mm-hmm. But if it's like a brand new account and they want to see if Wieden and Kennedy can what they can come up with, then we'll put together like. This is a spot we would make, and so I get involved sort of earlier in the process because of that. And so
okay.
At that point, you know, there are traditionally, you know, in advertising, there's the writer, there's the art director, there's the creative directors and stuff. And I think
I've seen Mad Men.
Yeah. Well, as you know, like all of that. Yeah, all of that is sort of like those boundaries between. What those people do is just sort of breaking down.
Yeah.
And so you really just have sort of a handful of people that all kind of like on the same page. And we all kind of just work together to kind of figure out what's the best sort of way to tell the story is or whatever.
Okay.
So goes back to that whole film school thing. I just really liked sort of, ultimately I just like being around people who are doing cool shit and being a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's kind of it. I never really had like, oh, this is the vision that I want to see as Tommy Harden, you know,
mm-hmm.
on the drums. that I want to see through. It's always just sort of like I just wanted to be sort of part of what Cool Shit is doing. So anyway, so I kind of get involved earlier on, and maybe half the time now I'll actually go on set and meet the director, work with the director, even start cutting on set, even. Like, we'll uh-huh. take the dailies that are coming right off the video tap and just start editing right on the spot, to see if stuff's working or not, you know? Uh-huh. Did we get that take, or do we need to go back and do it again?
Is this, I mean, shooting that kind of stuff, is that like usually you could do it like literally in the building, or is it like in Portland, or is it who knows
we
where?
We usually go fly down to Los Angeles.
Okay.
That's where the big film community is,
uh-huh.
and just due to 100 different reasons, that's just sort of where all the locations, and sort of you can kind of like, if you write a script, almost 90% of it you can probably find a location that looks right somewhere in Southern California, uh-huh. in a weird way.
Yeah,
unless you're like, say, doing something for the Olympics and you gotta like, oh, you want to pretend you're in China, or then you're in Canada, or you're in, you know, the UK, or you're in Brazil, and then you have to go to those locations and shoot in those locations.
Okay.
But for the most part, I mean, I think there are smaller jobs that shoot locally here in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the stuff that I'm working on, that it usually shoots in like maybe New York or in LA.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you consider yourself to have a particular style of editing, or do you kind of just let the project dictate that?
I think if you were to ask somebody else that question about me, about, or other editors about me, they would probably be able to say, yeah, there's that's a Tommy Harden edit. You know, that's how Tommy cuts. You know, that's
really
yeah, I think so.
Okay.
You know, oh, that's very much Tommy's sort of thing. Asking me about it, I have a harder time seeing it, and I do really want to be more specific to each story that each spot has.
Yeah.
And I would hate to be seen as a particular style, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to be like...
That fly loves it. This is like, what's all the flies in here? What kind of place is this? Sorry.
That's all right. I've seen, and that's one thing that's really, really great about being in Portland is that I can kind of have access to sort of all the different kinds of work that are coming out of Wieden & Kennedy, which some of it's comedy, some of it's poetic, some of it's more aggressive, some of it's, you know, some of it's just playful. So I can kind of taste all of that, whereas there's so many editors in LA that they start pretty quickly to sort of label you as, oh, that guy's a comedy guy. Okay. And then pretty soon, every job you have coming your way, let's say I did a really big Old Spice commercial or something, and I had that on my reel, suddenly they'd be like, oh, look, he's the Old Spice guy. He's the funny guy.
Right.
And so I'd be getting all this comedy stuff, and it was just like, I ran into an editor who does features, and he works in comedy. He does like some Apatow movies. And he was just like, God, I'm tired of doing comedy. I'm just tired. And like there are movies that if you and I talked about, they'd be like, oh, that's a hilarious movie. How could you get tired of being on like a Will Ferrell movie or something? But uh-huh. he's just sort of like, I'm ready to do something different. That's all. It's just you want to exercise different muscles, whatever. So I see that happen to editors in LA. They get, oh, that guy is a big, really big car guy. He knows how to cut like car footage together. And it's like, who wants to right. be pigeon-toed as that, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, that's what's great about being in joined is that, yeah, so maybe I have a style, and I think people would say that I do, but I maybe pretend that I don't. I don't know.
So how many other editors do you work with?
At Joint, we've got, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, I don't know, around that many.
Plenty.
Seven or so, yeah.
Do you... those kinds of projects, like let's say you're doing a particular spot.
Yes.
I love saying this is great. Do you like have, are you start to finish the editor, or does that get passed around ever?
Usually.
Yeah.
Usually. It kind of depends. Sometimes it's more than just one spot. It's a whole, like a body of spots that are all kind of, share footage, mm-hmm. you know, or it's a campaign,
right?
And so maybe I will cut some of those spots, and somebody else will cut some of the other spots.
I see,
you know, but usually, or oftentimes, you know, things go way, like things might go off the rails, and one editor isn't able to finish it because they've already booked on another job, and a different editor will come in and kind of fly in to finish up a job that kind of went off the rails for a bit. So we definitely have this sharing thing.
But it can be handed back and forth.
Yeah, but the longer form stuff, because we don't just do commercials, we do some other longer form stuff too, mm-hmm. and that's much more a shareable thing.
Yeah.
Like there is... I'm not sure where we are. You know, we're just starting the process of editing it, but at Joint, we're starting to cut a feature-length documentary film on Carl Jung.
Okay.
And so there's like three editors kind of figuring out how to do it right now.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Wow. That's sort of a random...
Yeah.
There must be a story behind
there
that.
There is, yeah. Okay. Well, I'm not sure if you want to go into that.
No. Okay. So now... How do you find music for these spots? I mean, is there a library you just kind of like look through, or can you like say I have a particular, like if you're really into Yola Tango, for example?
Yes, yes.
Can you reach out to them or their agent or something? You can,
yes,
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's I'm glad you came here because music is just so important, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, that's obviously something that we've shared in the past, and music is so important to me.
Yeah, I'm going to intersperse some of that probably now. I actually thought about changing the theme music.
Don't do it.
Don't do it.
Well, I mean, music is, I mean, the knowledge I have of music, or the sort, maybe not knowledge is the wrong word, the passion, or the sort of the way the music has sort of saved my life in a way, the way I understand it. It's kind of everything in a sense when I'm cutting. It's like, it's so important. Sometimes way more important than even what you're seeing on the screen. Mm-hmm. The music is just, it tells you everything you need to know is that track. So it used to be, again, because advertising was the redheaded stepchild, it used to be that the musicians that you and I would like, or music bands we would like, they would never consider one, selling their own music that they've made to a commercial, or two, even really composing something, unless they really needed the cash. Mm-hmm. You know, that has completely changed because of the record industry falling apart.
Mm-hmm. I mean, okay,
yeah, so it's good for me.
Yeah,
but I mean, like, I remember, like, I don't know, so let's say 10 or 12 years ago, there was like a Cadillac, huge Cadillac commercials and Led Zeppelin.
Right.
They use like rock and roll or something on that. And I, as a Led Zeppelin fan, I saw that and I was just sort of like, oh, gross.
Right.
You know, oh, man.
They definitely seem like one of the more anti-
Yeah,
their song,
exactly.
Zeppelin.
Exactly,
sure.
Zeppelin. Yeah. And then, but they were, back then, I mean, they were paid. If I'm right, if I remember, I talked to somebody, I think they were paid like at least $2 to $4 million to use that song for that those campaigns, you know? And then slowly but surely, those numbers like that came down.
Mm-hmm.
And then slowly but surely, bands started just saying like, okay, we need the cash, you know? And so, like Yola Tango, for example, they do. You can talk to their agent or something, and if they're if they're interested, they will maybe write something for you.
Mm-hmm.
They would never sell an existing track. That's just not who they are. There are some bands who can't afford to be able to have that stance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's one thing that I kind of, it depends on I kind of know what the budget of the music budget is as I'm starting to cut. So I know if I can maybe either one, look for an existing track that I feel like maybe we could buy and the band would be cool with having on the commercial. Or, you know, there is a library of stock music that's kind of already been written and just like ready to buy for commercials. And there's also like musicians standing by, or like we have music supervisors who just know musicians who can just kind of reach out and say, you know, hey, do you want to do a track and see if they like it, you know, like, and so again, like, it's amazing nowadays who you can actually get on the phone.
Have you ever been in a position where you were able to just reach out to a band and they said yes, and you were like, oh, this is perfect? Or is that still relatively rare?
No, that happens.
Okay.
No, that happens. Perfect is a hard term, because sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's really close and it's close enough and then you need to change it or something.
I mean, if you can talk about it.
Yeah.
One that's already been aired or something. You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wouldn't point to a specific commercial, but let's say, for example, okay, here's a story. Stories that I like telling is that because I'm constantly searching for music, I'm constantly listening for stuff, and I try and find people that might need the money, you know?
Yeah.
And so there was one time, it was like for a Nike golf commercial, and I had just been watching YouTube, random YouTube clips, and I found this guy who was like this beatboxing flute player.
Okay.
You know, he's a street musician. So there's just a video of him like playing the subway of New York, beatboxing on his flute.
Okay.
And I just fucking loved it. It was amazing.
Huh.
And so I start putting together this Nike golf thing, and it needs a certain rhythm. It needed a certain sort of like a hip hop sort of a rhythm to it. But yet I knew the flute kind of in a weird way kind of classed it up a little bit. So it's a little bit more like a playful golf thing, you know?
Sure.
And so I went to try and find this guy, but all he had was a MySpace page. You know, he didn't even have a label. He didn't have anything. He had like four tracks that he had recorded himself on MySpace. And we were able to contact him and call him up and get him paid. and he ended up, you know, on his music ended up on like a Nike commercial.
That's great.
You know, so I try and like, I really like supporting musicians who want to be, you know, who are cool with being on the air, you know, mm-hmm. whatever.
I remember, I think it was I had seen the Shins when they first moved to Portland or something, or
yeah.
I think actually I didn't even see the Shins. I think I saw the guitarist or the singer and a drummer. I don't think and the whole band was even here. And I was like, well, these guys are great, but I couldn't really hear what they sounded like. And then not long after that, they were in a McDonald's commercial. Do you remember that? Yes. And it was like that. It was like,
yeah.
And I heard it in the commercial. I was like, oh, it actually sounds good, but man, are they going to get shit about this? You right. know? And they did.
Well,
but, you know,
well,
then again,
that's the thing, is that the whole culture is changing now.
Now I think bands love to be in a commercial.
Yeah.
It's for a lot of bands, like to be chosen for an Apple commercial. Yeah. I mean, what a break that is for a lot of bands I've heard of for the first time in like a car commercial or a.
Yeah.
Apple commercial, specifically like iTunes.
Yeah, know. It'll generate sales and stuff like that.
Well,
I mean, hopefully the work that you're doing, you know, hope that the work I'm doing as an editor isn't shit that people would think, oh God, people are going to associate my music with this. No, thank you.
Right.
That's rare. It's rare. Mm-hmm. But you know. I'm really happy. I did a Levi's commercial about 2 years ago, and we found a track by Juliana Barwick, who's just this one woman show. And she at the time she was on Kickstarter trying to raise money to like actually put a record out uh-huh. on vinyl, you know. So the fact that we could, you know, put her on Levi's spot, and the thing is, the music worked perfectly with the spot, and I would not think at all. You know, it was like, oh, there's a Bukowski poem on it. She would not feel at all like her music was being bastardized, you know, by that commercial. It was beautiful. So, anyway.
There was a Bukowski poem in the commercial?
That was being read.
Oh, okay.
That was like the voiceover was Bukowski's, like a poem by Bukowski, yeah.
Huh. Check that out. Did you get to meet Clint Eastwood?
I stood near him.
Okay.
I wouldn't say I met him. I didn't talk to him. He looked at me.
Okay. Well,
I looked at him back. But we did not actually meet. Like, hi, Clint. I'm Tommy. Hi, Tommy. I'm Clint. That didn't happen.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So last time I think we hung out, you were really into Yola Tango. What are you into now?
You know, it
sounds like you have pretty broad musical taste.
Yeah,
these days.
I think sometimes you go and I go in phases, you know, mm-hmm. where I just can't find anything new that I like,
mm-hmm.
and I'm doing is going back into old records mm-hmm. and listening to old stuff.
Yeah, don't talk to me about it.
I know. but then all of a sudden I go through a phase and I like everything and I start listening to hearing new bands or new albums. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then I'll like buy too much.
Isn't that so true? And like I'll be out at a restaurant and I'll be like, you know, maybe I've had a couple of cocktails, but it's just like, they'll have some like stupid Pandora station and be like, what the hell is this? What is this? Why do I not know what this is? I'll be bugging the bartender, like, what's this track? You know, like I've used up my
Shazam thing.
Shazam for the month or whatever. I refuse to pay for it. I get like three or something. But.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and then I go out and buy too much, and then I'm like, I'll go back and like play the record, and I'm like, why did I get this?
Yeah. What was the track that hooked me here?
I think right now, where I've had the most success, or what I'm really liking right now a lot is Mississippi Records have their own label, and they've been re-releasing a bunch of old like folk music or Ethiopian jazz, like stuff that was on Ethiopics, and like re-releasing some of that stuff.
Sure.
And I love it all.
Yeah, like, I love that stuff.
Anything that Mississippi Records puts out, I'm going to try and look at least and see if I want to buy it. Because
here in Portland.
Yeah, here in Portland.
Okay.
Their taste is so good. And then, but basically anything, especially Ethiopian or African stuff, that stuff is just sounds so great.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really into that. I think one thing that I'm interested in now, because I think the whole music industry has sort of been affected so much since we listened to music and we're teenagers and stuff. Mm-hmm. And what I see, I mean, I think there's a lot of great music being made, but the problem that I see is production value is just sort of gone. People don't necessarily, even though the access to be able to record your shit and mix it in, you know, Pro Tools and whatever, you're growing GarageBand, mm-hmm. it's so great because it allows people to sort of just go record anything. Since everyone's listening to music on MP3s, and since everything is compressed, mm-hmm. I'm just hearing a lot of these new bands that I really like. It just seems like it wasn't recorded that well, or mm-hmm. just kind of just sounds like, oh, I wish I could get in there and mix it better. Or if I just feel, it feels like a kind of thin, it doesn't feel really fleshed out. And so to me, when I find an album that's been really well produced, I'm into it.
Yeah.
The last album, My Bloody Valentine record, the new one, is amazingly okay. produced. It just sounds so good.
I still haven't heard that.
Yeah. Guilty now. I listened to it on vinyl, and I'm almost scared to hear it.
Yeah.
Off my computer, because I'm afraid that it'll just won't be the same. But listen to it. If you got to run a record of it, listen to it on a record. It just sounds, it's so full.
Yeah.
It's like a bath. And of sound, and it's almost addicting when I put it on. It's like, because there's nothing else that sounds like him, you know?
Sure.
He has such a specific kind of sound that he's created, and no one else has really been able to kind of figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
And it just has a really great quality to it, like a really rich quality to it. There's a new record out by this band called Savages. I think they're from the UK, an all-girl punk band.
Oh, okay.
Really well-produced record. Like, it just sounds like a, I don't know, the bass could almost be like something like a, kind of like a Steve Albini kind of a bass,
okay.
and just a really full, heavy kind of a sound. Because like, I listened to some Tom Petty records like just a couple of weeks ago, stuff that was recorded in '81, and everything on that record just sounded good.
Yeah.
You know, just the guitar sounded great. It was just all right in the pocket.
Yeah.
And it was like, back then, of course, they had all these huge studios and the money and the gear and the microphones were all perfect.
Right.
And I'm like, that's what some of these new bands need.
Yeah.
Is sort of like, you know, okay, now you've got, there's a lot of creative voices out there that are doing great shit. I don't think anyone right now is being limited by genre. They're not being limited by radio, you know, by trends. Some people are, naturally, but it really feels like there's an explosion of sort of like new, interesting shit people want to put out there. But now I think the challenge is that teenager, like the average teenager, probably 90% or more of them have never heard anything besides a compressed piece of music.
Yeah.
You know, they listen to either the radio in the car, or they're off of their iTunes or off of a computer streaming live on a computer or whatever. And it's like, they don't know, like, not even, they haven't played a CD. Like, they don't even know what like a high quality recording sounds like. And I think that's got to be the next thing.
And I think it's not just that, but it's like when you combine it all, it's like, it's not just, I feel like a lot of it is, I always see people walking around just with like cheap headphones.
Exactly,
like
earbuds. Same thing. Yeah.
And like the difference between that and putting on a nice like record on a good system with speakers in a big room.
Right.
Like it seems to me to add like way more dimension. Like this is not possible in headphones. It's like, it goes way beyond like a binaural two sound source thing. It's like you hear like delays and all sorts of, you know, you can move around the room and it's a completely different experience.
Yeah.
It's like, not to mention a lot of them sound like with the place they were recorded and the, you know, I think a lot of people will start with something in GarageBand and they'll be like, well, we'll just overdub a couple of things in the studio to save time and then, you know, leave a lot of the basic tracks.
Yeah. I mean, okay, think about it I'm going to make a metaphor here. Think about it in terms of video, like in camera. Like, so suddenly you can go out and make a movie on a video camera. You can go out and shoot something, like a handheld thing, and it creates a certain kind of language. It creates a visual language, and it's like a loose kind of collagey, kind of like amateurish kind of a feel, and which I think is really great for certain stories, and it was really great when we first saw that happening.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's changing the way stories are told in a way. It's like suddenly now we're kind of missing that, no, a very purposeful, thoughtful, well-crafted movie that a film camera requires. Mm-hmm. And now a lot of the stuff is just kind of just feels loose, and it's like, where'd the craftsmanship go? Because it just kind of feels loose and mm-hmm. crazy, you know? Which I think is kind of, it was fun for a while. Like it was like Slumdog Millionaire came out, and that was all handheld cameras, and that was... that won an Academy Award for cinematography.
Yeah, like that was the that was when you got tired of it. It was like when like Blair Witch did it.
Yeah.
When it first got cool, yeah, and then it was yeah, like yeah. that was then it ended. Yeah. And then it was like, please, and, just
yeah,
don't.
That, yeah, exactly. Stop doing this, please. Yeah, yeah. And so the same thing, I think, musically, it's like people don't really, when everything is so highly compressed, you don't really hear the detail.
Right.
So why even care about the detail? And I just think people have sort of forgotten about it. And it also creates a different kind of taste in music.
Uh-huh.
Because if you, we're hungry for that bass that gets lost in compression. And we're hungry for that, those high-end
stuff. The dynamics.
The dynamics that aren't really there anymore. So they got to feed that hunger doing other things musically. And it kind of creates a bit of it, this sort of like... A manic quality to the music, that you don't really need.
Like acoustic desperation.
Yeah, that you don't really need if it just felt bigger. Yeah. If it felt more full.
And not even, it seems flat now. It's like it's ruined my ability to shuffle in iTunes, because if you put something recent in there, it just sounds so loud. It's just pegged on the level, and then. Like one of my treasured old Beach Boys things will come, which is super dynamic. It'll start out really quiet, and like. Like I was really into Do You Want to Dance, their cover of that.
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, that thing has like fucking kettle drums. And like, kettle drums? Are you shitting me? And it's like, and it, you can tell it was recorded in a great studio. And obviously he had a great ear.
Yeah.
And it's like, it just keeps building. Like every time they get to the chorus, it's just like, there's this new crescendo. Or even, you know, simple stuff that they did. It was like, if you look at the sort of the waveform over the whole song, it really builds where you just don't. It's like pop songs now. They just like they gotta catch you in 5 seconds.
Yeah,
maximum
that's
loudness.
The, yeah, and that's the whole listening to songs versus albums, you know, thing.
Yeah.
It's like if people go, I do this. I go on Spotify, and it's like if it's a new band I haven't heard of, I go to like their Spotify profile. I see what's popular, and I play one track.
Oh,
and,
sure.
And then it's like, oh, you know, I'm halfway through the track. I'm like, I've decided whether or not I'm into it or not.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to before, you had to like. You know, invest the money to actually buy it mm-hmm. as opposed to just sort of hearing it for free or go to your friend's house or like borrow their tape or whatever, and you could never be able to just sort of like fast forward through one track and say, nah, I'm done. Like you would have to listen to the whole side at least, you know, or at least like what I would do, I would buy it, and I was with my allowance.
Yeah.
I'd buy the tape and then listen to it like 4 times to convince myself, you know what, I just can't like it. I need to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah. I have this weird memory just now of the, and I'm still friends with this guy on Facebook. I won't say his name because he's probably in the clear by now. But he used to print out on this old dot matrix, you know, tear off the spool sides of like all of the albums that he had that he was willing to make you a copy of in exchange for, in my case, I would make him copies of games on like a floppy disk.
Oh, really?
So we would swap, and that was where I first got copies of like Beatles and all that stuff. Very primitive music swapping.
Well, I mean, think about it. I mean, back then, if you didn't want to hear what was on the radio,
mm-hmm.
what were your options?
Mm-hmm.
If you weren't interested in what was playing on the radio, what could you do? Like you had to like know somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or like in my case, I didn't know anybody, so I would buy Rolling Stone and I would read all the reviews in Rolling Stone and mm-hmm. like anything that sounded interesting to me, I would just buy it, and then if it sucked, I would just return it and sell it. But I kind of just, that's all I could do. I just had to find some other source of magazines, and then it wasn't until, you know, I got into high school that I started meeting people with other people with good taste like yourself,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly we could like, oh, let's make tapes.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of crazy to think of that you couldn't just click on a track.
Yeah, and I would have to like I remember when I bought my tape to tape deck, you know, where I could actually make my own tapes. And, oh, that was a good day.
Yeah,
because then I could go borrow tapes from anybody that I knew and make copies of them.
Yep.
You know, and that was like, and you'd buy those like blank tapes. And I was like, oh my god, I can get 10 tape, you know.
Amazing. And then you'd punch out the little hole. Exactly. So you wouldn't accidentally record over it. Then you'd tape over that because you did want to record over it.
You know? And so, yeah, it was like, it was so much more like about the people that you met and like what was their taste like. And you would get to know them because of the mixtapes they would make for you. And it's like there's something about even buying a record, like when we had that record on all summer, uh-huh. and it was like, I go back to it and open it up. I'm like, oh, I remember when I got this. I remember who I had a crush on, or I remember what uh-huh. the fuck was going on in my life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like,
it really had a sense of
yeah,
place. For
when's
sure,
the last
yeah.
time you could say, like, oh, I remember when I downloaded that track? You know, I really remember when I, like, that day when I clicked on that iTunes button.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you talk about like how much more important journalism seemed, and I suppose it is now.
Yeah.
But in a different way. You know.
Well, the raw quality I think it's different.
I mean, I think this might have been with you. I remember going there. Was like, do you remember that record store or Folk Joke?
Oh, Opus? Yeah, yeah. Totally.
Or maybe Garage Door. It was Garage Door, and they had a basement where they'd keep old copies of like
right.
every music magazine. Yeah. And you could like dig through those. It was just a whole basement of music
yeah.
magazines.
Yeah.
You could dig through them and find like a great article on REM from 1984.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And you'd like buy this old copy of a magazine just because you were so starved for, you know, good writing
right.
about the music, because
yeah.
it was the only way you could really. There were so few people who would listen to something like that.
Well,
in
yeah.
White Bear Lake,
well,
you know?
Yeah. When we used to just go, that was like our destination of choice.
Yeah,
is just to go to a record store uh-huh. and just flip through the records, and like, even though we'd already knew what they had,
right.
even though we'd already flipped through them 100 times,
right, right. You'd do the same.
We just wanted to see them again because where else are you going to get a chance to even see the artwork or like even think or mm-hmm. talk to the person who worked there mm-hmm. about what this band or whatever? There was that like Dyke who worked at Orfolk. Who was there like for the replacements when they made like their Stink record, and she
yeah.
was like helping
yeah.
put the stamp on the
yeah,
Stink stamp.
She was really into. Was it like New Zealand rock?
Yeah,
do you
exactly.
That?
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, and so.
Which turns out is actually good. I just refused to listen to it back then because she was always putting down the Pixies. It was like, well, screw you. I'm not going to listen to New Zealand rock.
But yeah, it was all about like, it was like in order to listen to or find good music, you had to find cool people.
Uh-huh.
And it was about what they were passionate about. And there was just a sort of this human connection we had to have,
uh-huh.
Which, you know. I still want to know what people are interested in music. Like, what are you listening to?
Uh-huh.
You know, it's always interesting to me.
Uh-huh.
And I'm at the point now, like I'm in one of my phases right now where everything sounds good. So uh-huh. it's kind of dangerous for me to buy records right now. But I don't know. I mean, I can like almost anything sometimes, it seems,
uh-huh.
because music is so great. But I'm just kind of, I kind of miss that quality, that's more tactile human quality about music, which now it just feels so. I'm looking forward to the time when everything kind of sounds better and production gets higher. And like this whole, I think the bit rate thing and all of the compression thing will be solved soon. But anyway.
I hope so.
Neil Young's working on it. I don't know if you heard about that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I am generally an optimist, but I don't know how much Neil Young can move the needle for the whole industry, but we'll see.
Well, I think the good thing
is he like putting out his whole catalog in like high def Blu-ray, something like that.
I don't know what he's doing exactly, okay. but his catalog. But he's making this thing called the Pono, P-O-N-O.
Oh, I hadn't heard of that.
Yeah, where he's
sounds like one of his albums.
Well, he's trying to make a device like an iPod that actually plays things back at like full quality.
Okay.
Which really at this point isn't a software program that could really read it that quickly unless you were playing it back on a tape or playing it back on a record.
Like, I wonder where you would set the upper limit, like 96.
It's 96 or above is where it's at.
Like 24-bit, not 16?
I don't know exactly. Go look it up.
Well, yeah, okay. Put it in the show notes.
But
you heard it here first, folks.
But the thing is that he's been trying to do it for years. I think he was trying to do it with Apple because he had a relationship with Steve Jobs, and
mm-hmm.
I think they were working on it. But then when Steve died, they kind of just brushed Neil aside. So he kind of kept doing it on his own. he said he's going to come out with it last year. Didn't really work. Then he said. Then he said 2013.
He had a Kickstarter.
I don't know. Yeah, I think he's talking to people. I think there are other devices now that are going to try to do the same thing. But when people say they've heard it, it's basically like listening to the original studio tapes. You know, it's better than CD quality. But the thing is, I mean, I think back when the iPod first came out, it was like, oh, look, I can put 200 songs on this little box. And now it's like, I can put 200,000 songs on this little box. So it's like, okay, so now we don't really need 200,000 songs. What we need is like 20 albums that are all like the highest quality. And that's, I mean, that seems like doable, right? It'd
be great if we could just proportionally compress the music on your iPod. So if you only had 20 songs, they'd sound amazing. But if you had like 2,000, it would sound pretty good.
Right.
So there's an idea.
There it is.
Maybe for the Pono 2, whatever. Cool. Okay. Well, so tell me what else you've been enjoying in Portland in your 6 years here. You have any favorite restaurants or recreational areas?
I think food, the food scene here is definitely kind of ridiculously good.
Yeah, I think so too.
If you don't realize that, if you live here and you don't realize that, you're spoiled rotten, because go visit some. I was just in New York for a large portion of.
I went back to Minneapolis recently.
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, there are a handful of good, if you know where to go.
Yeah, yeah.
But here, that's everywhere.
Yeah.
You could go to any corner.
Yeah.
But I was in New York, and in like even this like huge city of New York, it's like people were like, oh, this is a great place for lunch, or this is a great place for lunch. And I go there and I'm like, oh, Portland. I miss Portland. The food here is so, and it's cheap. You know, you don't have to like go to the fancy restaurant to get something that's just fucking amazing.
Yeah, even on 82nd, despite all of its setbacks, there's some like amazing ethnic food out here for sure. There's like you get like this great like banh mi sandwich for like $2.50.
Exactly.
It's like, whoa.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll sell it to you. Some lady just yelled at me today and said she would not sell me anything on the menu. I was like, look at it. I was like pointing every part of the menu. I couldn't figure out. It was just no, no, no. And I was like, well, how about tomorrow? And she's like, 2 o'clock. Like, I'm not gonna wait till 2 o'clock to eat a sandwich. So, but you know, that's
The food scene here is great. I think also. Speaking of music, the fact that it is a music town and a lot of good bands feel like they need to stop in Portland on their tour, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
The venues are small. Generally, the crowds aren't annoying, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting going from city to city, moving around a lot and kind of seeing how the different crowds are at different towns. It's really, the Portland vibe is great.
Yeah.
It's really friendly and excited, but not annoying. And weirdly enough, the vibe in LA is quiet. Like they're almost too cool to enjoy themselves.
Oh.
Like they're very respectful.
Okay.
They're very quiet. And they're like, oh, yes. That was a very good show. Very good show. And it was.
You see a lot of live music?
You know, not as much as I'd like.
Yeah.
I used to see it a lot more. But that which leads me into the other part of Portland that I like is I can just chill the fuck out here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think in being an editor, it's really hard to be an editor in a city, or do what I do in a city like Portland. Normally, I have to go either to New York or LA, and those towns are just really hard to live in. There's great people there.
Uh-huh.
There's great things to do there. There's plenty of awesome shit happening, but it's just that day in and day out it wears on you, and I feel like when I lived in LA for like 5 years, I had no. I couldn't decompress. It was just kind of always go, 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 go. And whereas here in Portland, I can work a joint and get that sort of like jet fuel, that insanely intense sort of working late night hours and doing like being really like focused and creative. But then when I leave, I can just go home and just be king of the introverts and just disappear and just or ride my bike or just like walk around the neighborhood. It's just sort of like, it's so easy to live in Portland and I don't feel like there's any, I don't know, there's any need to sort of like, it's just something very, I can just check out. I can just check out in Portland.
Yeah.
It's great.
I've definitely come to terms with Portland. It's nice. I like it. It's totally not what I thought when I moved here. You know.
Yeah. So but when did you move here?
I think I've been here. I would probably say I moved here in 1999. Uh-huh. It was right before the Y2K because I remember stockpiling jugs of water. Like, great, I'll live for an extra week. I don't know what I was thinking, but that's how I sort of remember it. And then,
so what were you expecting when you came out?
Well, I think I was sort of still like not settled, so I was kind of thinking it would be like just overrun with hippies, and,
right?
Like, I'd be able to get mushrooms at every corner or something, and, which actually you probably could back then. It's just gotten way more, like, I feel like the city's grown up along with me. Like now it's like I was a vegetarian back then and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And not to imply that you should grow out of that, but just that I did, and that like now Portland is like, it seemed like a super vegetarian-friendly town. Now it seems like a super meat-friendly town.
It is. And yeah, the meat eaters win in this town, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. 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 I mean, and yeah, like you were saying about restaurants, it's like, I will walk into some random place. I will be like, I'm going to a show. We went to a jazz show at the Mission the other night.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, what's the nearest restaurant? I'll just go there at happy hour and just get something to eat.
Yeah.
And it was called Fish Sauce. And it was amazing. It was like really good. And like they had like hundreds of whiskeys. They made like amazing, amazing drinks. It was like, this is ridiculous.
And you just wandered in. That's exactly what happens in Portland.
And it was like totally affordable. And
yeah.
Everyone there was nice. What more can you ask for?
Exactly.
Cool. Is there some place that... listeners who are interested should keep up with you online? Are you really into social media? Or
you know, I'm not.
Not really. Okay.
I'm not really a social media guy.
They should just watch your portfolio for interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Do you even have a portfolio?
If you go, well, it's called The Real, maybe.
Okay.
If you go to jointeditorial.com,
okay.
I think you can probably find my name on there somewhere. You can kind of get an idea.
You have no idea, do you? Like, I don't know. Just Google me, and if it doesn't say drummer, it's probably me.
Yeah, I mean, no, I'm not really computer. I mean, I'm on a computer all day.
Right, exactly.
And at one point, I think I realized how I'm constantly in front of a screen,
uh-huh.
be it a computer screen. I have two computer screens that I'm looking at side by side, and then I've got my two different TV screens that I'm watching stuff
right.
on. And then I've got like when I'm trying to figure out my life on my phone, that's a screen I'm looking at.
Yeah.
And if I go home, there's a TV screen I'm looking at. And at one point, I think it was maybe about a year ago or something, I was just sort of like, okay, no more screens. Like, fuck screens.
Yeah.
I'm looking at screens. It's like, what does that do to my brain? And so I have to look at a screen all day for work, and I'm constantly looking at images constantly.
Mm-hmm.
I just realized I needed to take a break
yeah.
from anything on a screen. So I don't spend a whole lot of time online. Yeah.
So you don't have like a, you don't put video on Vine when in your stage. Kidding. Okay, cool. Well, Tommy,
yeah.
thanks for chatting with me today.
It was great. I wish I could have actually asked you a lot more questions, too.
Oh, well, next time you can interview me.
Okay, great.
No one's done that yet. Cool.
Okay, bye.
So this is episode 21. It's been like 3 months we've been doing this. After the first few episodes, maybe the first episode or two, I did it in GarageBand.
Mm-hmm.
And then I finally broke down and bought Logic 7.
Okay.
Thinking, well, this has been forever. I don't know if Apple's ever going to update that thing. Big news today.
Oh, really?
Logic 10 came out. Been waiting for this for like 4 years. So pissed because Apple has no longer does upgrade pricing because they use the App Store. So it's $200.
Damn,
I know, fist waving at Apple. I knew that they would update it eventually, and I'd been hearing things, but I didn't think it was like a...
I feel as though we may have talked about this.
We did. Yeah, we did. We were talking... I don't remember what we were talking about, but I was saying, you know, that I'd heard things, but they... And then, boom, just dropped. Looks amazing.
What are the amazing parts? What's...
You know, nothing that I need for podcasting.
But hey, maybe you'll set up that home studio you've been thinking about since
right,
you were 12.
Something like that. It's like, you know, it's redesigned. It's for my purposes, it'd be mostly aesthetic, which does not justify the price tag. But, you know, it looks nice. It's great. It's Retina. But yeah, way overkill for this modest little podcast. So, let's see, what's news? Well, so I listened to this week's musical selection.
Yes.
Musical pick. Over Under Sideways Down, a.k.a. Roger the Engineer, a.k.a. The Yardbirds, which is what it's actually called. Mm-hmm. It's an eclectic handful of music. Everyone seems to like it. It's, you know, in the Yardbirds catalog, it seems to be highly regarded. But
their only album of originals,
right?
Entirely originals.
That's not really a
selling point.
Yeah, I don't know. It's honestly, I think the songs are just not as well written. You know, my favorite Yardbirds was like hearing their live stuff from like 64, 65 with like Eric Clapton. Like there's this one where they, it's like, I think it's just five live Yardbirds or something. Mm-hmm. And they play a cover of I'm a Man. But they play it really up tempo and really good. Like that's the Yardbirds. It's like hearing the Beatles before they were in the studio, like when they were really like a club band and they would just play like just raging fast stuff. And it's like listening to this, it was more like they were trying to sound kind of like psychedelic, but then there's like some bad blues in there, and I don't know, it just didn't have a storyline. It didn't really grab.
Yeah, it just I had the same reaction. Like it was like one song to the next, it was like a completely new thing.
Yeah,
and like there was just no
nothing,
no narrative to it, like no cohesion.
Yeah, and it just the production.
We know this song.
Yeah,
we also know this song.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't know if it was that everyone was credited or that they were all credited for all the songs, but it just kind of sounds... I don't know why it's so highly regarded. Honestly, when I was like 17 or 18, I would have loved this album. I probably did. But now listening to it, it's just kind of like... It's just like noisy and abrasive and yeah, it doesn't...
Also, one thing I sort of found interesting, at least, was you could hear the influences of their contemporaries. Like, mm-hmm. There's one track that sounds a lot like an early Kinks song that they probably are aping. There's one song that sounds like really early Who. And, like, they would have been, if not playing together, like, certainly aware of each other.
Yeah.
Like, and you can so hear that, like, they're, like, trying on these sounds from one song to the next.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in that case, it was kind of an interesting like piece of, I don't know.
One thing that's always struck me about the Yardbirds is for the fact that they were like this, almost like a showcase band for guitarists. You know,
super group before the super parts were super.
Yeah, they tended to have really, really anemic guitar solos. Like at least on the hits that they had, you know, Heart Full of Soul. You know, it was like
anemic. How like?
Like just really boring and really simplistic, like they were just like really, really bad. Or like on Over Under Sideways Down, it's like it's just like four notes going up and down. It's just like it's just this like annoying drone. It's like if you don't have anything to contribute, maybe you should leave the room
and take the guy on the harmonica with you, because that shit is awful. Ugh.
yeah
this just solidified my hatred of like amp. Harmonica outside of any folk context is just bad.
Yeah.
It just reminds you of like the gym teacher who got up with the band at the show to jam, like, because he knows how to play harp. Like, sit down, mister.
Yeah. Yeah. And another thing about it that was odd was that on the version I got, like an idiot, I bought this album.
Me too.
But, oh God. There's a, I think Needmore needs to reimburse us for this. the last five tracks are, I guess, Keith Relf solo endeavors.
Yeah.
Which I have to say, some of those were better than the Yardbirds ones.
I didn't make it that far.
Yeah. They I don't know, it was, it's just kind of like, it's still the same band playing. I don't know why he was trying to, what he was trying to pull there. Anyway, enough about this album. Let's pick one for next week. Unless you want to rant on this some more.
No, I'm done ranting.
No, okay. I might like it more after a while.
I'm not even sure, like, without liner notes. Like, yeah. I'm not sure, like, where Jimmy Page came in. Like, I know, like, there are some tracks at the end of the album where he and Jeff Beck are both playing. And I didn't, I couldn't hear it.
I think it might have been, like, the instrumentals that come later after the actual official album. I don't think he actually played on this album, per se.
I know he's on Psycho Daisies.
Okay. Yeah, I don't...
But I didn't...
That's like a...
I didn't know if there were other tracks.
Is that actually on the album? No, that's like an outtake. The album is only the first 12 tracks you see there.
Oh.
And then there's like the 7-inch versions.
Lord.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's a crap like Jeff's Boogie, which is like...
Terrible.
Bullshit boogie-woogie shit with Jeff Beck playing boogie.
It was apparently the B-side of the title track as a single.
Okay.
And they denied that it was... a cover. The bastards. The lying bastards.
You know, this is kind of like the birth... Like, you could plot a line from this album to Zeppelin's first couple albums.
Mm-hmm.
Like a direct line. Like one by one, the Yardbirds were kicked out and Jimmy Page started pulling in people to form his band. But it's like... I mean, at some point, they were going to be called the New Yardbirds or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then he decided on Led Zeppelin or something. But.
Keith Moon? Keith Moon gave them the name.
That's right.
Yeah.
It was like a joke that
gonna
bombed.
Go over like a Led Zeppelin.
Yeah. So, we're running out of unique bookmarks for the...
Oh, we've got a collection.
Do we? Okay, let's go. Hold on. Hold on, everybody. Okay, so I am thrilled at next week's pick and honored to have chosen it. Elvis at Sun.
Wow.
Just flipped open to it. What's funny is I've been listening to that album a lot. I don't know if it's the exact same one they're talking about, but it's... Bookmark is extremely confusing for a simple man like me.
They'll get you.
Nearly a year after he'd walked into Memphis Recording Service as a paying customer to cut my happiness as a gift for his mother, 18-year-old Elvis Presley was summoned back to the studio. Head honcho Sam Phillips had a new song his assistant thought would be right for that boy with the sideburns. How exciting. So... the Elvis at Sun. I don't know. I have one that's like that, but it's different. This one was apparently released on RCA in 2004. I want to see what the Elvis that I have here is. Maybe it's the same. So it is the Sun Sessions.
Well, I'm looking on...
Is it the same?
Elvis at Sun... Wikipedia is telling me is a compilation that was put out by RCA in the like about 10 years ago of his all of his early Sun recordings. Whereas like the Wikipedia page for this has the track listing with the original LP credit, and like the complete Sun Sessions are where I don't know a handful of the songs are coming from.
I wonder if like that it's a subset of the Sun Sessions.
Yeah.
The Sun Sessions is like the first half is like a, I don't know, like 16 tracks, which is of just the songs he'd recorded, then a bunch of outtakes, you know, like abandoned takes of, you know, that's all
Milk
right.
Milk Cow Blues Boogie.
Right. Is that one of them?
That is one of them.
Milk Cow Blues Boogie.
Yeah, I don't know that song. And I feel like my life is a little less.
Yeah, we'll need that one. Need that one going for sure. Okay, well, that's great. That's great. That's great. You know what else in other music news, mm-hmm. last night I watched on iTunes a documentary.
I saw that, yeah.
I highly recommend it.
I saw that it was released onto iTunes and on demand and stuff like 2 weeks ago.
Right.
And immediately rented it from iTunes and I haven't watched it yet.
Have you started it?
No.
Oh, so you still have like 10 more days.
I haven't even touched it.
Okay, wow. So. Yeah, you got to watch that. What is it? What is it called? Let's see.
We're talking about
yeah.
Big Star.
Yeah, for all you listeners who are like, what the hell are they talking about? Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll put this in the show notes. You know, I have to admit, I've lived and loved Big Star forever. They're like one of my favorite things to listen to in the whole world. But I never really knew much about their story at all. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know just like what I've gleaned off of like essays about Chris Bell dying or like things when Alex Chilton died and like just picked up stuff, but I'm really excited to actually sit down and watch this. How good was it? I want it to be very good.
Yeah, it was good. Well, I would say this. I would say if you just watch the first hour, it's almost 2 hours, then you're probably fine. Because it's kind of like the first hour is like really well produced and they have tons of interviews with people and they're talking about the actual band's career.
Mm.
And then it's like the second half of it is almost like they ran out of their special effects budget. So it's just kind of like interviews. And it's like after they broke up.
Lots of Ken Burns wipes.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it's just kind of like talking on and on and on about their solo careers for the next like, you know. So it's like the first hour was like magic. And the second hour was like it is interesting. I mean, Chilton's career after that band has been notoriously patchy
mm-hmm.
and awkward. Like, I didn't know that he produced the Cramps' first album, for instance. That was the surprise for me.
Perfect fit.
So odd, so odd. But he got so into, like, really bad punk, like, really worthless garbage. But then there was, like, some, not punk in general, just the stuff he was into was particularly bad punk.
A staple at CBGB's for a while,
yeah.
But into like the weird stuff.
Yeah, he was in like this into like really weird dark southern, mm-hmm. you know, rockabilly punk.
That's funny.
Westerberg
make an appearance?
Yeah, briefly they showed them, you know, an interview with the Replacements where he was ranting about how good Alex Chilton mm-hmm. was. Yeah, Chris Bell, boy, that guy went nuts. Nuts. It's just one of those, like, people that shouldn't, you know, just wasn't meant to be in a band like that. But, yeah.
Better than the Eagles documentary?
It was. Well, I like the band better than the Eagles.
Okay.
So, you know, there's a personal bias. So the thing about the Eagles is they're all still alive.
Mm-hmm.
They're just generally dicks. Like with Big Star, it's like they're mostly dead, but they seem like really nice people and just really, you know, kind of just like just nerds, you know, just geeks. It's a shame that their music wasn't more successful, but you know. can't see why anyone would have thought it would have been, really. They just seemed kind of out of step with where music was at that time anyway, and, you know, there was a crazy guy in the band. It's just...
like that's ever stopped anyone.
Yeah, but he like worked out for Pink Floyd. He apparently like went back in the studio and erased the original recordings of the first album.
I didn't know that.
Like apparently they just kind of had a key to the studio, and he was just resentful of Alex Chilton getting more press than him or something. So he just went in the studio and just started erasing the master tapes until someone like caught him and dragged him out.
Yikes,
that's a shame. Although there was one point in the documentary where they were doing that thing, that tease, where like the one guy who still has the master tapes is like playing with the faders and like, oh, listen, isn't it cool when you hear this version? Like with the, and it's like, screw you, give me that version, put it out so I can have it. I don't want to hear you talking over it. I want to just hear.
Have you ever seen Questlove sit down with the original masters of What's Going On and talk about it? He talks about it with this music historian, like music critic. It's on YouTube. They're like 2 15-minute videos or something. It's amazing. Like Questlove just, you know, is like an encyclopedia of all things music. And he's talking about Marvin Gaye, and like they're talking about the history. Who is he sitting with? He's sitting with like the librarian at whatever label, whoever owns Motown now.
Oh.
Like, wherever the archives are.
Yeah.
Like, he's sitting with him, so that guy, like, knows everything about the tracks and everything. They're amazing. These videos are so super. But it's a lot of that. Like, they're just, like, dropping. Like, let's just listen to this drum track. And it's the only time I've ever seen anyone do that on film and not being bored by it or not have that reaction. Like, give me that release.
I don't know. It looks like it's owned by the Island Def Jam Music Group. Wow, that's a catchy name. The Island Def Jam Music Group. That's like worst band name ever. Cool. All right. Well, we'll see you next week. And do listen
to
the.
Boy, do I know how to end a conversation.
Do listen to, you know, but some of the best stuff I've heard is like the. Like I had a recording of Paul's Boutique. But just the vocals, no music. That was surprisingly listenable. Same for Pet Sounds. Both actually really good albums where the vocals stand up on their own really well and the music stands up really well on its own. Like you could listen to both just the a cappella version and the instrumental version of either of those albums and be entertained, I think. Okay, well, I guess we'll see you next week. Elvis at Sun.
Elvis at Sun.